Welcome, ladies and gentlemen, to Sublimely Gothic, the podcast devoted only to the most sordid and macabre tales ever penned to paper. Here you shall explore the darkest jewels of literature with gothic enthusiasts Amy and Jess. Enter this realm at your own risk, for the night is dark and full of terrors. Welcome to the show, everyone. This is Season 3, Episode 4 of Sublimely Gothic. I'm Amy.
And I'm Jess. And
today we're talking about The Strange Case of Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde by Robert Louis Stevenson. Published in 1886, this gothic novella gives a physical manifestation to the duality of man and explores how we process good and evil. 3,000 copies were initially printed, but stores did not stock the books until a review appeared in the Times, giving it a favorable reception, after which the next 6 months, close to 40,000 copies were sold.
Wow.
So many sold because they were like, just cost like a penny, like they were really cheap and like it was the quintessential like penny dreadful.
I was just going to say the good old penny dreadful, how funny. This, I'm assuming, came after Treasure Island. I'm trying to find that out right now, but I wonder if it came before.
He wrote Treasure Island. I know very, very little about this writer. And in fact, his writing style is not really my favorite. So I don't intend to read anymore.
I don't either. I listened to the Audible book of this because I've read this before, but it's just been several years. And I just kind of kept thinking like, whiny man. Like, that's the whole thing. I was like, gosh, just get over yourself. But I am just familiar with Treasure Island. I think when I was a kid, it was like there was a movie version that came out. So I either tried to read the book or read the book. I don't know. You know, at this point, I'm like, I don't know what I have read and I haven't.
I know Treasure Planet was such like one of the biggest flops for Disney, but I think it's underrated.
I'll have to see it.
Oh, you haven't seen it?
I haven't. I don't know what movie I'm thinking of because this is like back, you know, 20 years ago, maybe longer than that. But
again, but no Treasure Island adaptation will be better than, of course, Muppet Treasure Island.
You just put Muppets in anything, it's ultimately better, I think.
My favorite scene is they're doing roll call and Sam the Eagle is like, big, fat, ugly, bug-faced baby eating O'Brien. And this woman comes up and says, I. And then the next guy on the list is Angel Marie. And then a really ugly Muppet of that same previous description is like, I.
That's pretty fun. I love how often the Muppets come up in our Gothic podcast. It makes me very happy. It's great.
But anyway, this is not about Treasure Island. This is about Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde. And again, one of those ones where I knew basically what it was about and had high expectations for it because the whole duality of man and like the yin and yang and that sort of thing, that's really my jam, like philosophically, spiritually speaking. So I thought I would be really into this. And I was into the themes of it, but in terms of its execution, like writing style and other things, I liked Dorian Gray better.
Oh, hands down, Dorian Gray. I liked Dorian Gray better as well. And I kind of feel like I saw a stage adaptation of Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde in Texas like 20 years ago, and it was really entertaining. And then to read the story, I just kind of was like, it was so funny revisiting it. I was like, this is just not my jam. I did score it really high on our Gothameter for a couple of things, but I don't know why. It didn't vibe well for me.
But first, shall we get into our 60-second recap?
Oh, God bless it. Yes, let's do it.
I'll go first in 3, 2, 1. So we've got this lawyer, Utterson, who finds out that there's this guy creeping around his buddy, Dr. Jekyll, and he's Mr. Hyde, and he does all sorts of terrible things. He tramples a little girl, and all the bad shit he does, he gets Dr. Jekyll to, like, pay for it, and that makes others think, oh, is my buddy Jekyll being, like, blackmailed? But Dr. Jekyll's be like, oh, no, don't worry about it. And then Mr. Hyde actually kills someone, and then ultimately comes out that Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde are one and the same person via a chemical, some sort of magical chemical serum that ultimately Jekyll was able to control the transformations, but now he can't anymore. And he's, you know, driven mad by his duality of self and the separation and merging of those two. And he ultimately he decides to kill himself. And yeah, 2 seconds to spare.
Okay. I was like, this is so short. And okay, let me get my timer ready to go. I mean, you pretty much nailed it. I don't know how much I'm going to be able to add, but I will do my level best. Okay. 3, 2, 1. All right. So there are a couple of rich guys and they're dancing around London, not really dancing around, but, you know, traipsing around London. And they run into Dr. Henry Jekyll, who tramples a child. Might be the only girl in this story. Anyway, so there's a bunch of nefarious things that happen. People are suspect of who this person is. And then a person is killed. Again, who is it? Who is it? There's ends up to be as a beverage that is drunk that creates this different person. Turns out that it can't control it. Eventually, the bad side overtakes, and the story ends with him writing a letter. If he can actually get the letter written, and then he dies. So,
indeed,
wasn't my best rendition.
Pretty short novella, all things considered.
Yeah, it kind of makes me think about how it became a stage play. I remember seeing it, and I, after reading the novel or the novella, it's not even a novel, again, I was like, how do they boost this out to be a stage play? You have talked a lot about the duality of man, and I want to hear what you have to say about that, because when I wrote about this in I think it was Gothic Monsters when I read this, I talked about alcoholism. So I want to, which, you know, there's an argument there, but I really want to hear what you have to say about the duality here.
Well, I think it's something that has fascinated humanity for a while. The whole dichotomy between like good versus evil, like, you know, the public versus the private. And I was even looking on Wikipedia, and in fact, some people have even made the stretch to consider the duality as in like Scottish separatism versus British unity in Jekyll and Hyde.
That, wow. Okay. That's interesting.
I don't know. Again, it's interesting to talk about duality between good and bad, particularly how it's manifested in this novella. It's very Freudian.
Yes, it is. I can see how.
Yeah, and I don't know how much stock, and, you know, many elements of Freudian theory has been discredited. And then also just the idea that, I don't know if Dr. Jekyll, Mr. Hyde was the birth of it, maybe in a more modern sense, but it has been a trope in like certain, maybe the thriller genre or in movies, the idea, the pop psychology phenomenon on multiple personality disorder.
Okay. Yeah. That makes me think of who was the famous Sybil.
Yeah. And so like in reality, in psychology, the way that it's been presented in media, again, multiple personality disorder, it's been like, not that it doesn't exist in certain capacities, but it's under a totally different name. They use a different name for it, but it's not really so much a thing. So the majority of it has been discredited.
Interesting. The idea of multiple personalities has been discredited pretty much. Is that what
you're Or thinking? At the very least, it doesn't manifest itself to the same degree that media or maybe certain defense lawyers want to pretend that it does.
I getcha. Okay. Okay. Yeah.
You know, people, again, the whole question of criminal insanity.
Yes. So this whole, like, so specifically with Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde, which I have all kinds of questions about his transformation, but, you know, the whole idea that he is this completely different person once he drinks the tonic, which is to control that side of him or to enhance that side of him. I think I got confused there.
I again, that's the whole question. Like, what is the purpose of separating the good and bad for oneself? It, like, I kind of think of it as a type of purging, that I can only be the best of myself if I allow this worst part of myself to run rampant from time to time.
Okay. Okay.
Like, so, like, what are those thriller movies, or The Purge?
Yeah, I'm aware. I've never seen one.
I haven't seen them either, but I know the basic idea of the, you know, the idea that The Purge, it's this one day in a year where, like, people can just kill whoever, and, like, all emergency services are discontinued for that night, so people can just do whatever they want and go crazy, and then everything goes back to normal the next day.
Yes. Yeah. So
horrible idea.
Yes. I mean, I feel like we live in a dark enough time that, like, let's just not entertain that. But I know that some people's, like, catharsis is watching things like that. Not mine. I guess I prefer things in old-timey London, but.
Yeah. So that idea of what does it serve to separate those two and give a sort of, again, physical manifestation of the bad side of ourselves. And then I'm just curious about, specifically with Mr. Hyde, why does the baser self crave violence?
You know, it does. It's always like one of two things if it's going one way. It's either like sex or violence. And in this way, I guess probably the time that it was written, it couldn't have gone too much in the sexual deviance sort of way. But it definitely went in the violence way. I just, like, it's not funny, but the fact that he, like, tramples a child, I was like, what? Why is this something that happens in this story? It just kind of made me just pause and think, like, what? He's running over a child? What the hell is going on? So yeah, that was, like, to me, that was just weird.
Yeah, it's a weird, like, sort of, like, crime to open up with Mr. Hyde. Because, again, when I think of trample, like, that specific verb, because I rode horses, I immediately think horses. So I'm like, did he run his carriage over the girl, or, like, what?
Oh, that's interesting. I wonder, like, in the context of which it was written, because I think of, like, a concert and people being trampled. I wonder what that meant at the time. It says, I mean, he was running over a little girl in the street. But either way, I mean, I guess it's kind of not quite murder. I think she lives, so yeah,
she lives, and, you know, they have to pay for, like, the medical bills and stuff like that.
But he doesn't, like, straight up kill the child, which, I mean, he kills somebody later.
He kills, like, Caro, whoever, later. Again, I'm so not invested in these characters, I barely remember their names.
Well, that's the thing, that I think that's why I'm having a hard time really talking about it, because, like I said, you know, it was just sounded like old, or just sounded like a bunch of men whining, and I was like, I don't even know if there's a female character in here beside the maid and the trampled child. I think that's it.
Yeah. But going to the question of, like, why does the baser self crave violence? Because to me, it tends to be more, again, it's always sex or violence. Sex is the obvious one because sex is pleasurable. But I think of violence, even in my baser self, I'm thinking, like, what does the violence get me? Like, if I'm protecting myself, if, you know, if someone's attacking me, yeah, violence serves to save my life. It's a self-preservation thing. Or in a sense of, I kill this person and take their stuff. So greed can be one. But in the context we're given, like the trampling of the child and the murder of, like, Caro, what did Hyde get out of it?
I guess just entertaining that base herself. Like, I don't, I guess that was something that I didn't fully understand while.
Yeah, like,
this,
does the baser self just automatically include sadism?
I'd like to think no, but I mean, I guess in his instance, it did.
Or if it was a very specific revenge.
Yeah.
Like, yeah. If you take the sadism, like, doing, I can't remember the specifics of, it seemed to me that the guy he killed just stumbled upon him. Like, there wasn't any, like, sort of, oh, he knows my secret, does he? Or, like, he did something to me?
No, and I think that's, again, that's kind of why this is just kind of not really resonating. There wasn't any, like, emotional thing. He killed a Sir Danvers in the streets, and it for no reason other than maybe he was there. Which I guess maybe that's just trying to highlight how, you know, unhinged he could become, is he's committing a murderous act that has no sort of emotional element to it. You know, we talk about, like, crimes of passion and things like that, where there is an emotional reason, but this is just when there's just a completely, I can't think of the word, arbitrary reason to kill somebody. It's just like, oh, killed this person just for the hell of it. Is that, you know, I don't know if it's, I don't want to talk about if it's more or less malicious. It's just more and more strange. I guess that's why it's called the strange case of Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde.
Yeah, because even in my dark recesses of my personal Miss Hyde, like, I can't imagine causing pain to someone unless they've legitimately done something to me.
Yeah.
To harm me either physically or psychologically.
Maybe mine is more of like, if it was the case of Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde and he was like out, you know, having a good old time on the town with everybody, that might have been more up my alley. But
yeah, because in many ways, again, it's all about, you know, violence or sex. Like Dorian Gray, it's all about the sex, and Hyde, it's all about the violence.
Yeah, maybe that's why I like Dorian Gray a little better, because I would prefer that than this. It just seems so foreign to me. I can't vibe with Mr. Hyde.
Yeah. But again, one of my notes here is, first, the transformation is something that Jekyll can control, and then it gradually becomes involuntary, his transformations. So what do we think about that allegory for just human nature, that, again, natural, once we're put under more and more psychological pressure, our ability to restrain ourselves becomes less, less, and less?
You know, I think that when I wrote about this specific to alcoholism, that was kind of one of the basis for that, is that you're kind of letting the alcohol take over so much that you can't really control it. And I made some pretty obvious, like, looking at the text, connections with the, you know, the tonic that he drinks and stuff like that, which I, like I said, it was pretty basic. But I also think that during the time when this was written, this was written in England. So I don't know if, you know, we're obviously not talking prohibition, but I know there was a lot of women were suffering at the hands of men who were, you know, drinking too much and still do. So that was kind of the direction that I looked at it in, is when you're just kind of so controlled by, you know, you enjoy a substance and then it kind of takes over your life, that the argument could be made that that is what happened here. So it's hard for me to detach from that analysis. You know, and again, I think you could also apply the duality, base duality to that as well, because I don't know, but the alcoholism just keeps standing out to me.
Yeah, no, and that's interesting, because I never thought about it from alcoholism or substance abuse or anything like that. Ironically, I don't know why that never came to me, but for me, it's always purely been about the deep, like, subconscious of, like, very Freudian, that, like, people just cold sober, you know, get to a point psychologically that they just snap.
Yeah, I think that both of those, I mean, and that's why I think there's so many things written about Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde. When I was doing my research, it was like, there was plenty to read about it. And because you can look at it in so many different ways, for as like light, and I'm not talking about like as in subject matter, but just as, it's not a huge investment to sit down and read it. Like, you can read it probably in, I don't know, an afternoon, but the things that you can take away are pretty interesting. And then just that kind of human analysis, or, you know, the story, like you said, just the duality. And I'm thinking of the duality that personally, just kind of on a very surface level, of things that I like to invest in, you know, sometime I'm really into this one thing and then I kind of convert over to this other thing. Now, I don't think either of the things that I'm interested in are violent or, you know.
Yeah. And it's human nature that we always want to divorce ourselves from the bad side, not purely to be in conformity with what society, polite society, you know, expects and demands of us, but just our whole moral spirituality, that aspect of our lives. We don't want to think of ourselves as bad people. So when we didn't have like modern scientific and psychological explanations, like quote unquote multiple personality disorder. You know, we had people attributing negative out of character behavior as, you know, possession of by demons.
Right. Yeah.
That required an exorcist.
Yeah. Right. And
yeah. And yeah. So we always, you know, since the dawn of time, have always want to be like, oh, I didn't do it. That guy did it. Or if we're really, really, really forced in a position where there's no way I can pin this physically on someone else, it's like I can pin it mentally on someone else because that wasn't me in my right state of mind.
Yeah, I think that that's an excellent point. And I think that's the thing that, you know, we all kind of struggle with. I think everybody makes a mistake or does something in a moment of passion, and you kind of have that hide moment where you're like, that wasn't me. I didn't do that. And then you're kind of like, but it was. And what you do with that information from there, if you say, oh, that was a mistake and I'm going to change my behavior, hopefully it's not an extreme. You know, you always hope it's not like you don't snap and do something rash. But I think that's really the part of your personality or like people's personality that you're looking at. Do you change that behavior or do you let it take over? Do you just keep falling down that path of like darker and darker? Or do you say like, I messed up and it's time to change?
Yeah, this story of Jekyll and Hyde got me thinking about I just scrolled around my social media and just it was an article. I didn't read the whole article, but just the headline of Virginia is like repealing that sort of LGBTQ plus panic defense.
What is that? I don't know about that.
So that's basically, apparently, I didn't even know this existed, and it's atrocious that it even existed to begin with, that basically upon learning of someone else's like sexuality or sexual orientation, like they considered that to be shocking enough and like provoking enough, like in the same way of when someone finds out that their partner cheated on them and they kill them, like that was considered like a defense. That, you know, it was a moment of passion upon realizing their sexual orientation. And I'm just like, this was a thing and we're only finally getting rid of it?
Well, that's atrocious. I had no idea that was something that existed. But
yeah, like literally the LGBTQ plus panic defense.
Well, I hope that goes away because that's horrible. On a much lighter note, apparently the Hulk was, I guess I forget about the Hulk, but he was inspired by a combination of Frankenstein and Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde. And I was wondering, did you think about Frankenstein when you were reading this? Because I did.
I did not, actually. I did not think of Frankenstein. Again, the biggest thing, because that was the most recent thing we read, was Dorian Gray. Because I think the sex and violence are so intrinsically linked that we have one being all about the violence and one being all about, you know, the sex.
Well, I think I understand the reason I thought about Frankenstein. And again, it's like, it sounds like I'm like, I'm in the theater all the time. I'm not. But I went.
And even if you were, why would that be a bad thing?
It wouldn't. I guess I'm just not trying to sound like, you know, like, oh, also, anyway, I don't need to explain, but I saw a production of Frankenstein, and I've mentioned it when we talk about Frankenstein with Johnny Lee Miller and Benedict Cumberbatch, where they alternately played.
They switched it up. Yeah.
Yeah. And Frankenstein. So I kind of had the realization. I was like, oh, that's why I thought that, because it's just kind of, I'm sure that was a little intentional. To kind of do the Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde. And I'm sure you can make an argument that the creature is like, I don't know, is he the good guy or the bad guy? I don't know if I've ever decided. But so that was the only reason I thought about that. So I'm sorry to know it didn't come up because I was like, oh, interesting. But anyway, sorry.
So yeah, I got a few discussion questions from the ether, that is the internet.
Cool.
So here we go. In our general cultural understanding of Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde, we typically get the sense that Jekyll and Hyde are two completely different people, when in fact they are one and the same in Stevenson's original story. How do you think the difference alters the story, which is more frightening?
The difference, like if that the fact that they're one person versus two people?
Yeah.
Okay. I think it just because it's like a mirror, you know, I think kind of what you really talked about, like those moments when we have those really dark thoughts, the fact that what if that took over? To me, it's more terrifying being in one person than two people. You can kind of go, okay, well, this guy's an idiot and this guy's like chill. But so what do you think?
I guess, I don't know. It's hard because it's like in our jet, the way they say it is we typically get the sense that Jekyll and Hyde are two completely different people. But I would make the argument that this is so well established in not just Gothic literature, but general classic literature, that I would think most people already know the basis that Jekyll and Hyde are ultimately the same person.
Yeah. Yeah.
But in terms of which is more frightening, yeah, the idea of that you can via the serum or whether we do alcoholism or just extreme psychological pressure, that ultimately we can become this truly terrible person and not have our full mental faculties to restrain them.
Yeah, I think that's, I mean, something I've thought about and just, yeah.
You know. And it makes sense why this specific book was in your Gothic Monsters reading list, because what is more terrifying than man?
That's very true. Yeah, very true.
Yeah. Stevenson relies heavily on cityscapes to inform the mood of his story. Did you think that these descriptions were effective?
100%. To the point that I give this, I mean, we don't have to talk. I'm going to get the atmosphere was absolutely key to this, I think.
And this is definitely, again, going in the opposite direction of, you know, the original Gothic was all about the rural manor house or castle. This is going into 19th century, early 20th century, the urban Gothic of the sort of paranormal, dark, dingy streets of London.
Yeah. I thought this was a really effective part of the story. Like, I just, it was just everywhere. So I
thought if anything, excellent. You know, again, we'll get more into it in the Gothameter. But the fact that this stood out more than the characters themselves, going into that old stereotype about Gothic, it's all about like the ambiance and like the like melodrama than the characters themselves.
That's an excellent point. Yeah, that's a little sad that that's like this was so prevalent that I'm like, I mean, I know Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde, but these other jokers, like, I don't know what the hell their names were.
Yeah. The narrative approach of the novel is quite dry and factual. Even some might say scientific. What does this style contribute to the story? Which goes into one note that I had that I did not mention, but I was less invested in the demise of this man. It was less a story as it was a case study.
That is a great way to frame it, because that's exactly what it was. And I think I like to be in my feels about my characters. And this one, I was just like, all right, this happened.
Yeah. So in many ways, it was sort of like alternative, like science, if you will.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. Like giving the description of this, what's happened to this one guy when he separated his two selves. And again, because it's so dry and scientific, you're not emotionally invested and you don't get the same level of tragedy as I think. And I don't know, just the sense that was that intended by the author to be so dry and purely come at it from a scientific perspective? And if that's true, what is the author, Robert Louis Stevenson, trying to say about like humanity and the advancement of science and things like that? If he's not trying to get us thinking about these things on an emotional level, what is he trying to say by posing this this hypothetical scientific case study?
What is he trying to say? I guess by keeping it so scientific and very factual, it's creating a little bit of, you know, like you found something and a document and you're like, oh, this is just a record. And oh my God, this record's terrifying. So, but what is he trying to say more over that? I don't know, Amy. That's a great question, but I think you're a better person to answer it.
Again, I don't know either, because is he trying to say that this could potentially, we may get to a point, technologically speaking, that this could happen?
Like that you could split yourself, like one day I could be like working Jess and then I could be like creating crazy murderous Jess or
crazy burlesque dancer Jess.
I mean, that's more likely. So, Interesting. I don't know. God, I hope this isn't the case. Like, I kind of like the, or I guess, you know, I guess maybe that would be extracting all the bad parts then, you know, I guess, or the societally unacceptable parts, which that gets in a whole other conversation.
Yeah. And I think the part of the reason why I don't really immediately consider like alcoholism with Jekyll and Hyde, not that it's not a great allegory, but I just the way I personally view alcoholism and alcohol consumption, because I can be totally drunk and I'm still not going to, and I may be silly and I may be a little stupid or clumsy, but I'm not going to be a belligerent asshole. So I think there's a sense of people's like neurochemistry and how they respond to different things is different. But for me, it's just hard for me to let go, to buy into the argument that you have absolutely no control over what you do, even when you're really, really drunk.
Yeah, I mean, I kind of think it depends on a host of circumstances. But, and, you know, as far as like my argument that I made in that paper, it was just an argument to make. I personally, I'm not sure how I feel about it. But I think alcoholism, drug addiction, just something like that, that kind of, it's not really so appealing, but it just is so consuming that it kind of makes you into a different person. I don't know.
I would make the argument more that, because alcohol is a depressant, like it kind of dampens your senses. Like I would think more of like if you're on crack, then you're going to really do some crazy shit.
Thankfully, I don't have any experience with that. So I have.
I don't either, again, which is why I don't naturally go towards those things, because I've never had to resort to substance abuse.
Well, there we go. Good. Good.
Okay. But here's another question. Thinking about narrative perspective as well, why would Stevenson choose to tell the story from Utterson's perspective rather than Jekyll's? With what does Utterson's perspective provide the story?
I asked myself that. I'm glad this question was asked because I asked myself that question about the writing style. I'm like, why do we even care that these two people are having this conversation about this person? And I don't have a good answer. I think that it was a way to, again, kind of remove that emotional element, I guess, you know, until the very end. And then we get Jekyll's perspective because he's writing the letter. But I don't know. It was kind of, I just also thought maybe it was just like the thing to do at the time. I wasn't sure.
Yeah. Well, first off, purely from a storytelling perspective, I think Stevenson did it because, again, you know, Jekyll and Hyde is so well established in our cultural and literary psyche, but not everyone knew how the story was going to pan out, you know, when it was published as a little penny dreadful. So Utterson is a tool for us to continue to believe that Jekyll and Hyde are two people, which could have been done. Again, if we had gone back and forth between Jekyll and Hyde's perspective, it could have been done. But Utterson is a third party that helps to explain away that the ultimate, like, you know, plot twist that they're one and the same.
Yeah, it's, I know I always forget this, is that, you know, this story is so well known in our society, looking at it from the perspective of somebody who isn't familiar with the story and how effective that may have been back in the day. I think you make good points.
And again, what else does Utterson provide? And I think he shows the like compassionate how do I want to phrase this? He represents the compassionate friend who wants to help someone out if they're having a hard time. Like this could have easily been, you know, Utterson and Jekyll confiding him, oh, I have a drinking problem. And it's like, oh, I'll help you out then, you know, blah, blah, blah. Like definitely Utterson is that sort of, he's a lawyer, but also he's like the sort of like guardian, because he's at once really suspicious that Jekyll has changed his will to leave everything to Hyde.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. I'm sorry. I'm just trying to think through what you talked about. I don't know. I think that that's a good point to have somebody kind of like contradictory to what I said, to give some empathy to these characters and to also kind of see like, oh, how is this the same person? I didn't love that. That is kind of my biggest grievance. Like how he changed so dramatically to not appear anything like himself, to provide this like confusion, confused me, to be honest.
So just the whole nature of the transformation and the serum?
Well, just like that his physical appearance was so altered that people didn't recognize him. I just was kind of like, I don't know about that. But maybe, I don't know.
I think it's more like symbol. I think more it's a symbolism of we don't want to see the resemblance.
Okay.
As he is Hyde truly so physically different from Dr. Jekyll? Or is it we immediately see the bad and we don't want to admit that, oh, this is my friend?
That's a great point.
My impression is that certainly the potion or serum or whatever changes him a little. But if they were immediately under the suspicion that could these two be the same person, if they looked at them and just be like, oh, yeah, they are. But they are just not operating under that assumption at all. And they don't even think to operate under that assumption. So it never comes up.
Good point. Yeah. Yeah, I guess I could see that. And that's kind of like, you know, when you want to just look past things and because they don't fit the story in your head or something like that. That makes
sense. Yep. And then what other question do we have? Oh, after his first transformation, Jekyll initially describes his actions while in the semblance of Edward Hyde with I as his subject of choice, but later in the novel eventually shifts to using he and Hyde after the first time he transforms into Hyde unwillingly, stating, he, I say, I cannot say I. That child of hell has nothing human, nothing lived in him but fear and hatred. Do you think Jekyll is accurate in doing so, or is he simply too horrified at what he has become to accept it?
I think he's too horrified at what he's become to accept it. So he has to do this mental game to remove himself because he just doesn't believe he's that person.
Yeah, to disassociate himself.
Yeah, yeah.
And again, going back to the old, I can't admit that I did it or whatever. So, yeah.
Right, yeah.
I don't know. Like, I guess it's the nature of the transformation, because there is something to be said about Edward Hyde was I when he was making the decision. So when his transformation becomes involuntary, like again, from a really deep, like chemical and like neuroscientific perspective, right. when do you say that, okay, that, you know, it's like, like werewolves, the idea that, you know, if a person transforms into a werewolf, they have absolutely no sense of self, no sense of being in most folkloric tales. And if it's a story that we give a sympathetic light to the werewolf, then we don't hold them accountable for what he did as a werewolf because that transformation was involuntary. You know what I mean?
Yes, 100%. Like, it's just so beyond, like when you can't, that I understand the desire to separate.
So in that way, when Hyde becomes an involuntary transformation, can that be the same as lycanthropy where we give him a pass? Or again, I tend to think of it more as, again, like alcoholism, like you choose to drink that much if you know that you don't behave well when you drink that much. So in my sense, it's kind of, yeah, it can be involuntary, but at the same time, Jekyll, like you kept doing this, knowing that it was kind of not going all that well.
Yeah. I don't know. I mean, if it's something like turning into a werewolf, then I guess I didn't get that impression. But maybe that's just something that I'm too dense to have to have read, that that's where Stevenson was trying to make it go. But I guess a little bit of that gets lost because of the lack of emotion and the scientific kind of, this is this, you know, this post-it note's pink, not this post-it note reminds me of a rose in a field or something like that. So we lose some of that because of it's the way it's written. I don't know.
All deep questions. So,
yeah.
Oh. Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde is sometimes described as a forerunner to the detective novel. Do you agree or disagree?
Wow.
I disagree.
Okay, I was going to say I could stretch and probably say, sure, I agree, but it did not hit that. That is not the first thing that came to mind when I read this. So you disagree.
Yeah, I disagree just because there is a murder that happens, but that's not like the ultimate mystery of the story. The mystery is that this is these two personalities are in one body. So for me, like, the ultimate detective novel is about solving a murder. And as that genre has evolved, that murder often happens very, very quickly in, like, at least the first third of a mystery novel.
Yeah, I was going to say, since you kind of gave it a definitive, you know, no, I know you read more mystery than I do. And I know that's like one of the genres that you really like. So I feel like it definitely has more elements of horror and gothic. And one of the genres that our friend Morgan writes for, which is, urban fantasy, maybe moreover than detective novel.
And there is a subtle difference, I think, between just a mystery and a detective novel. Because in a detective novel, you know, to me, a good detective mystery novel, the detective is solving his murder, but he also has his own, like, you know, internal and external conflicts.
Right. Okay.
So, yes. So Utterson, in this case, again, not a memorable character that much. He's purely a vessel to understand, again, this case study of Jekyll and Hyde. So you could say maybe more a forerunner to a mystery novel more so, but even less so a detective novel because it doesn't have that, you know, strong detective protagonist.
Yeah. Okay. That's the detective novel is even more of a stretch. Absolute. Interesting.
Another question on the same note, would you consider Dr. Jekyll / Mr. Hyde to be an apt metaphor for a modern day serial killer?
No. Sorry. See, this is my favorite thing to do in life is to say something definitively and then backpedal and change my mind completely. So I guess as far as serial killers, I got very passionate about this really quickly, I think. As far as serial killers' ability to like acclimate to those around them, I'm thinking about BTK, who his own family didn't know that he was BTK. So I guess there is a little bit of Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde to like somebody like BTK. I don't want to say his name. I don't know a lot about some of the other infamous serial killers. I guess, you know, there was the clown, John Wayne Gacy, but,
Zodiac killer,
Ted Bundy.
I don't know. So, to me, a serial killer can completely disguise themselves within polite society. So the sort of complete unleashing of all the violent and negative aspects of oneself in Mr. Hyde, that does not coincide with a serial killer who has to like be cool and contained to be able to perform his murders and not be detected.
I feel like the kind of, like you said, the kind of operating in just polite society is more to lure a victim than it is to than kind of the act. And I never got the impression that Jekyll wasn't like trying to bait somebody so then he could get all Hyde on him. It was just like, oh, I'm average Joe. And then I'm like, oh, I'm losing my mind here. So
yeah. And all of the people he attacks, it's not, again, premeditated. They just cross his path and he's like, oh, this will be fun.
Yeah. Yeah. Most serial killers really
are much more methodical than that.
Yes. Yeah. Put in the work sounds like a compliment, and I'm not complimenting serial killers.
Yeah, no. Another part of this question, you know, modern day serial killer, it says, keep in mind that the actor Richard Mansfield, who portrayed Dr. Jekyll in a play adaptation, was one of the prominent members of society accused by the public of being Jack the Ripper.
I mean, at this point, who wasn't accused of being Jack the Ripper? Sorry, but
C.S. Lewis was also accused of being Jack the Ripper.
I mean, I don't know what to say about that because Jack the Ripper is a mystery and I don't know if that will ever be solved. So
I think Jack Ripper was a woman.
You do?
I don't know. Just in a way they're honoring the depravity of Jack the Ripper and the way he killed with these very high profile men. When it's maybe it was another prostitute who had a beef with them.
That would be a much more interesting story and take. And since you're a writer, I think that would be an interesting story if it hasn't been written already. So please. Yeah.
I still need to read that series. I'm Stalking Jack the Ripper.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, I remember seeing that.
Yeah, no, I found the first one at Goodwill, which is interesting because it shows a girl wanting to be a scientist, specifically in the Victorian era when forensic science started to be treated as a legitimate field of study.
Interesting. Cool. I'll have to know how it is.
I got one last question. The Gothic literary tri-tech consists of Frankenstein, Dracula, and Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde, three monsters who have become one of the most basic parts of our cultural vocabulary. What about these three monsters is so important to us? How are they different? How are they similar?
Interesting that those are the three that they chose.
I've never heard of this sort of triangle. It makes sense because, again, the vampire, the Frankenstein's monster, something that was created but external, and then the monster of man. So, like, I get it, but yeah, I've never heard of this.
Yeah, I'm just trying to wrap my head around it because it's, you know, everybody knows how I feel about Dracula at this point. He's just kind of like in a class of his own.
Of course.
And Frankenstein, I almost feel like that as well. Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde, that's just so interesting because I'm trying to think of who else I would have put in that third position and I can't think of anything better. So I think you nailed it. Just, you know, the kind of three points, the man, I guess, supernatural creature with Dracula and then man-made creature with Frankenstein's monster. But I want to read more about this. This is the first time I'm a little ashamed as somebody that took a Gothic lit class. I didn't know, but.
So how are they similar? Well, Dracula is kind of similar in the sense that the whole nature of vampirism is that you become a monster yourself. So in that way, you're becoming a Mr. Hyde.
Okay. Yeah.
And then Frankenstein, again, is just something totally external that was created. Again, this is hard.
It is. It is. I'm really trying to think about it. And
first of all, why are these three monsters so important to us? Again, well, Frankenstein represents, it's so important because it shows mankind's folly in pursuing the most technological advancement without thinking of potential repercussions.
Yes.
Dracula is important to us because it shows us, again, there's a timelessness with vampirism. So it's like the corruption of the past coming to the future, if you will. And then again, Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde, just the duality of man.
I think too, could we, you know, we talked about Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde hitting up on the violence. Dracula, I feel like there's always a strong overtone of sex when you talk about vampires. And then Frankenstein's monster, you know, kind of the power of man to do things for in the intention of good, maybe, and create something monstrous. Again, like I said, I don't really know how the jury's still out on how I feel about the creature, but they're all in different classes. They're in classes of their own. So it's hard for me to think about them as a collective, but they're all very important in the genre of Gothic literature. Otherwise we wouldn't have read them all. So
yeah. Again, how are they similar? Again, they're just similar because they represent various fears within the human psyche.
Yes, yes.
And they externalize those fears in a variety of ways.
Absolutely, absolutely.
Alrighty then, shall we turn to the Gothometer?
Let us turn to the Gothometer, yes.
Alrighty then, category number one, atmosphere and setting. What did you do?
I gave it a 10, and this was the easiest 10 I think I've ever given anything we've read so far. It was just atmosphere trumps the characters in this story. What did you give it?
Yeah, I gave it an 8 for very similar reasons because it is one of those quintessential, definitely in the urban paranormal camp. Category number two, the past. What did you think?
This one is one I struggled with. I gave it a 7, and I think my 7 was just because I didn't really know what to give it. I think the ending could kind of be like the closing of this was all something that happened and you're finding it. So it happened in the past, but there isn't a lot of reliance on the past. It seems to happen a little bit in real time. What did you think?
Yeah, I gave it a 5 because, again, just the nature of the linear progression of Utterson figuring out what is going on. So again, not a great emphasis in the past, even if we have the end with all the letters from Jekyll. Yeah, I put it at 5.
5.
Yeah.
Cool.
Category number 3, the supernatural.
The supernatural. Given our whole conversation, initially I gave it a 10, and I'll just stand by that because I can't think any further right now. But given our conversation, I think that there's an argument to be made. We really don't know. Well, I guess he's drinking some potion that's making him morph into this other thing. So if we just take the story at what it is, you know, that's pretty unrealistic. So I'm not proud of my 10, but I'll keep it. What about you?
Yeah, I gave it a middle ground 5 for the exact reasons that it is clearly a sort of magical component, but at the same time, kind of rooted in, again, things like alcoholism and substance abuse and things like that. And I'm sure in the future, maybe someone will create something crazy like this.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yep. And it's going to show up in the papers. Or maybe something like this has already happened in the past and no one knows except when you become like the president. And then like once after the inauguration, the next night, they're like, okay, here's all the like crazy conspiracy theories that are actually true, but we don't allow the public to know.
I'm sorry. I've been reading a lot about QAnon right now. So I'm just going to keep my mouth shut about some of that stuff. But I think that's interesting. Yeah. I mean, yeah. We don't know what that position knows.
Yeah. So I'm sure there are many things that like maybe they know about aliens. Who knows?
I think they do.
So yeah. So run of the mill, like a supernatural element of the story that is based in science, kind of like Frankenstein, but not quite yet, more predictive. But anyway, yeah, 5. Category number 4, heroes, heroines, and villains.
I'm giving this a 2. And the reason I gave it a 2 and not a 0 is because there were characters in it. I didn't care about them. I didn't really even care about Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde. I guess, you know, nobody was a hero in this. Villain. I mean, I guess when you talk about somebody being, you know, having a duality, you talked about their Mrs. or Mr. Hyde side. So I gave it a 2. I'm cool with that. What did you give it?
I gave it a 4 just because, yeah, you feel bad. Like, again, on an intellectual level, you feel, oh, that sucks for Dr. Jekyll, but did it pull at me emotionally? No. And again, if they had used more pathos in regards to the whole tragedy of the duality of Jekyll and Hyde, maybe I would have scored it higher. But yeah, no, didn't do it for me.
Yeah, I need like Katrina's, you know, like horrid. That's the kind of thing I like that.
So. Yeah. Category number 5, mystery.
I gave it a 4. Again, a really low score. I do the thing where I forget that this is something that people hadn't read before. And the mystery was just kind of, I just kind of like did a little shrug. So a 4. What about you?
Okay. I gave it a 4 for all of those reasons.
Whoa. Look at us.
Yeah. So I'm just tallying up our scores right now. You gave it a 33 altogether.
Yay. That's kind of, the atmosphere gave this points. My kind of silly 10 for supernatural gave this points for me. But it's funny to rate something kind of not super high that is kind of one of the quintessential gothic novels. But whatever.
Yeah. And ultimately, altogether, mine was 26.
Wow. Okay.
So yeah, that mine was really, really low. Because... Again, I was disappointed in it because there are probably plenty of other novels, gothic or otherwise, who with more emotion and more pathos can convey the themes of the duality of man more so than Jekyll and Hyde did. And I feel like maybe this is, it's a product of its time of really, again, being gothic being the precursor to speculative and science fiction. So this was really hot at the time, but now it's just meh.
Yeah, it's one of those that I'm like, I'm glad I read it. I can say I read it. I don't know if I'll ever read it again, but yeah, I read it.
And I'm not in any way motivated to read any of his stuff again, because there actually was a really nice like edition of, not Treasure Island, but another book by him called Kidnapped.
Okay.
And I thought it looked so shiny and like I wanted to get it just on that, but I'm just like, I don't like this rider. It's just going to sit on my shelf. I know. Like it should, I should leave it for someone who will actually want to read it.
Yeah. Yeah. I don't, Robert Louis Stevenson, may you rest in peace, but I'm probably not going to pick up one of your books. So sorry.
Yeah. Alrighty then. I've got my Jekyll and Hyde book here, which was also from Goodwill. Although this book I have, it's not just Jekyll and Hyde. It's also other short stories. And they have, he wrote something called The Body Snatcher. That's lovely.
That sounds really gross.
Yeah. Okay. So here is the section I found. Foul play, cried the lawyer, a good deal frightened and rather inclined to be irritated in consequence. What foul play? What does the man mean? I daren't say, sir, was the answer, but will you come along with me and see for yourself? Mr. Edison's only answer was to rise and get his hat and green coat, but he observed with wonder the greatness of the relief that appeared upon the butler's face, and perhaps with no less than the wine was still untasted and when he set it down to follow. So this is sort of getting to a point, again, this was page 47. The novella is like, what, 107? Like, it's only, yeah, it's only 100 pages, isn't it? Yeah.
Yeah, it's pretty short.
So this is where it's getting to a point where Jekyll's behavior is becoming so erratic that even his butler, Poole, is starting to notice something and confides this in Mr. Utterson.
Yeah. I usually say, like, at this point, this is very indicative of the rest of the story or whatever, but this is kind of the, like you said, the kind of middle piece where we're almost to that completely unhingedness, but people are noticing. Like, I guess that's like when you have a problem and you're like kind of feel like the last to know, but everybody around you is like, this chick needs to lay off the, like, I don't know, orange foundation. I'm just totally surface level there, but yeah, so there, people are starting to notice, and I don't know.
Yeah, I have nothing to say.
Yeah, I was really reaching there, but it was, I felt that way about the story. I think that's pretty well reflected in our Gothometer scores. It was just kind of like, okay, now we know.
And again, because not only its brevity, but in a way, the way it's written, it kind of makes sense why it does much, much better as a stage play.
That, I'm so glad you brought that up, because I remember really enjoying the play. I mean, it was, I can see scenes of it in my mind's eye still, but the book is pretty forgettable.
Yeah, because the prose isn't that flowery or poetic like Dorian Gray was or other books, it makes sense that you can just get the dialogue and you can skip all the boring prose, you know, once you transform it to a stage play or a film, and it becomes more entertaining when the people playing the characters can put more emotion than is what is originally displayed in the book.
Yeah, and I think the kind of base of this story has been played out in a lot of different ways and much, much better, much more well executed in those different. I couldn't reference one for you off the top of my head, but I think, you know, it's kind of like you watch a movie and you're like, oh, yeah, that's really interesting.
Alrighty then, and that concludes episode 4 of Sublimely Gothic. Tune in next time in 2 weeks, and we will be going over a modern contribution to Gothic literature, which is the thriller Home Before Dark by Riley Sager. And have you finished reading it, Jess?
I have not. I've been kind of holding out on it because I wanted it to be fresh in my mind, but I did like Riley Sager's Final Girls. It messed with me mentally. So I'm trying to not freak myself out too much with this one, but yeah, I'm excited to read it.
Home Before Dark. I loved it so much. I'll eventually like buy my own like copy because it's that good. And then then his other book, Lock Every Door. I still need to check out Final Girls, but I've been so busy with Feast for Crows.
Yeah, right. Game of Thrones in it. I don't blame you.
Yeah. So yeah, stay tuned for Home Before Dark. Catch you guys later. Bye.
Bye.